My name is Mike Niehaus. I'm product marketing manager for Windows deployment from Redmond. Here this afternoon to talk about deploying Windows 8. So in today's session, what we really want to focus on is what's new from a deployment perspective. Not really talking so much about all the new features in Windows 8. So it's not a general what's new in Windows 8 session. You've probably seen more of that already this week. So what we're going to try to focus on are any new features in Windows 8 that actually impact the deployment process, changes to the deployment tools, those lower level tools like USMT and Windows PE and things that affect the deployment process, and then the deployment products like MDT and Config Manager that build on top of those. So how does Windows 8 affect all of those different areas? So we'll start at the kind of the bottom level with the Windows 8 functionality and work our way back up from there. So let's start off at pretty much as bottom as we can get. Let's start off by talking about the Windows 8 image and the installation time for the default Windows 8 version. So if you were to take the original Windows 7 media that comes from Microsoft that you can download from the Volume License Service Center, and look at the install.wim file that's present on that media, it's about 1.97 gig. When you apply that to the disk, that gets expanded out, and the expanded size on disk is about 8 gig. If you compare that against Windows 8, Windows 8's install.wim got a little smaller. So instead of being 1.97 gig, it's 1.96 gig, and when you expand it out on disk, it's only 7.76 gig. So that gives you a good idea that Windows 8 doesn't have any higher hardware requirements, doesn't require any more disk space, doesn't really require any more memory or CPU or anything like that. It's designed to run on the same hardware as Windows 7. From an installation time perspective, installation of Windows 7 on a virtual machine, running on a machine, on a workstation in my office, where you time that process from the time you kick off the installation using MDT until the time that the operating system is fully installed, takes about 15 minutes. If you compare that against the Windows 8 installation time on the same virtual machine, on the same hardware, so all other things equal, the deployment process takes about 10 minutes. So that's a good sign, too, that we've managed to shave off about 5 minutes from the installation process for installing Windows 8. So initially we thought, oh, that's great. We're taking advantage of the new functionality that's in Windows PE, that's in ImageX, that's in the operating system itself. And all of those together result in that 5 minute drop in the deployment times. But then we tried Windows 7 deployment again. So using the new assessment and deployment kit, the new set of tools that was released with Windows 8, to deploy Windows 7, which is fully supported, works just great. Using those new tools, we can also deploy Windows 7 in 10 minutes. So just by changing from Windows PE 3.0 to Windows PE 4.0, from the older version of ImageX to the newer version of ImageX, using the same images, we can get the same benefits just by switching over the tools. So a lot of the underlying improvements are actually in the tools themselves, in Windows PE, in the network stack, in the storage stack, in the imaging tools, just to make the overall process faster. So great, whether you're deploying Windows 8 or deploying Windows 7, by moving to the new tools, everything will just get a little faster. MDT 2012 Update 1 supports that today. Config Manager 2012 SP1 will support those new tools in the near future. So it'll be fairly easy to make that cutover, even when you're deploying Windows 7. Now, if you were going to do an upgrade, so in the case of an upgrade where you're going to download the Windows media, you're going to insert the DVD in the drive, and you're going to kick off setup.exe to upgrade your existing operating system in place, that process, when you tried it to go from Windows Vista to Windows 7 on a machine that had no apps, no data, that upgrade time was about 30 minutes. Okay, but the challenge came in when you tried to do that on a machine that had lots of applications, had lots of data. That upgrade process could easily take 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. And in the end, you were left with a reasonable experience that the existing applications would be preserved, the existing data would be preserved, the existing settings would be preserved. Everything would work reasonably well, because effectively what the upgrade process would do is extract out all of the applications and data from the existing operating system, wipe the disk clean, lay down a new operating system image, and then shove all that other stuff, the things that weren't part of the original OS, back into the new operating system. That involved lots of moving stuff around. So in the upgrade process, the screens that would be displayed said this might take a long time. Yes, this might take a very long time, depending on how much data, how much apps. So now switch over to Windows 7 to Windows 8. That same upgrade process takes about 20 minutes instead of 30 minutes. They've made significant enhancements to that upgrade process. So you would think that, okay, 20 minutes to 30, or 30 minutes to 20 minutes, that doesn't sound significant. But again, remember, that's with an operating system that has no apps, has no data. It's just a vanilla install of Windows 7 being upgraded to a vanilla install of Windows 8. If you were to add in a whole bunch of applications, gigabytes of data, doesn't matter what you throw on top of it, that upgrade time won't drastically change from that 20 minutes. Maybe it goes up to 30 minutes, 45 minutes, depending on how much data, how many applications, but it's not going to be the same multi-hour process as the Windows Vista to Windows 7 upgrade was. There have been some fundamental changes in the upgrade process that will improve that upgrade time regardless of how much you throw at it, and it's really tied into one specific enhancement that they made to the upgrade process. For those of you that are familiar with the user state migration tool, USMT 4.0 added a new feature called hard link migration. And hard link migration worked by not actually copying any files around. It would just add new pointers to the existing files on the disk using NTFS hard links. Very fast, because you're just moving pointers around. The upgrade process to go from Windows Vista to Windows 7 didn't use hard links. The upgrade process to go from Windows 7 to Windows 8 uses hard links. So that's where the speed increase comes from in the upgrade process, that it's not going to take that much longer, even as you throw significant amounts of data and applications at it. So, okay, that at least makes upgrades a more reasonable scenario, because no one wants to do an upgrade from Windows Vista to Windows 7 when it's going to take 4 hours compared to the typical wipe and load refresh process taking under an hour. But for Windows 7 to Windows 8, that upgrade process may be feasible, as long as you don't have any software compatibility issues or driver compatibility issues or things like that, the upgrade process should be fairly smooth to go from Windows 7 to Windows 8. That said, most enterprises will still say, no thanks, we would rather do the clean install of Windows 8 using the normal refresh process to do a wipe and load. Let's capture all the user state with USMT, let's wipe the disk clean, lay down a new application, reinstall the applications, restore the user state back into Windows 8, and then bring it up and running. That will still take probably around an hour, depending on how much data and applications you're moving around, but you know the exact state that the machine will be in as the process finishes. So, okay, upgrades have been significantly improved, but maybe it's still something that most people only do for their home machines, and it's not so much something that's done for enterprise deployments. That's okay. Just for comparison, if you were to look at the clean install time of Windows Vista on that same virtual machine, that 15 minutes to 10 minutes, if you try it with Windows Vista, it takes 30. So you can tell how much optimization has been made in that deployment process since Windows Vista was released to today with Windows 8. It takes a third of the time now to install Windows 8 compared to Windows Vista. So that's good. So that's kind of the starting point. That's where we're starting from. An image that hasn't grown, a deployment process that's gotten faster. Good stuff. Now let's start talking about features on top of that. One of the biggest deployment impact items is BitLocker pre-provisioning. As part of the deployment process, we can tell BitLocker to encrypt the disk while we're still in Windows PE and to only encrypt the use space. So those two together enable the encryption of the disk to happen almost immediately. By telling it to enable BitLocker in Windows PE when the disk is empty, when there's no actual used data, and only encrypting user use space, that initial encryption process only takes a couple of seconds. So, okay, we've turned on BitLocker inside of Windows PE. Now we have to apply the operating system to the disk. And as part of that process, the data for the operating system, all the binaries, all the executables, everything else, gets encrypted as it's being written to the already encrypted disk. But there are no protectors on that disk yet. So it's basically encrypted but freely accessible until the new operating system boots up. Once Windows 8 boots up for the first time, we can then turn on the BitLocker protectors to make sure that you then have to put in a password, you had to put in a PIN, you had to have a TPM, whatever other protectors you have in place. So that's nice. It can cut a lot of time off of the deployment process, because otherwise you would have deployed the full operating system, you'd have then turned on BitLocker, and you could use the machine while it was encrypting the disk, but it wouldn't be good to do that, because first, the performance impact on the machine can be fairly high as it's going through and encrypting all the used, well, actually every block on the disk. And you also will see that all the free disk space disappears while that's going on, which makes it fairly hard to do anything of substance on the machine, like even trying to download your Exchange mailbox for the first time. There may not be enough free disk space on the machine to even do that. When you do the pre-provisioning, you don't have to worry about that, because it's instantaneous when you turn it on. The data gets encrypted on the fly, and it doesn't add a significant amount of time to the deployment process. So this is one of those no-brainer items that as soon as you move to deploying Windows 8 with the new version of Windows PE, it just works. It just happens. The even better part of this one is that it also works with Windows 7. So if you're deploying Windows 7 and move to the new Windows 8 deployment tools, Windows PE primarily, you can do pre-provisioning of BitLocker even for Windows 7 and get the same benefits as a result. So that works really well. Two other changes in BitLocker in Windows 8 that are nice. One is you can set it up so that there is a network unlock protector, so that when the machine boots up, if it sees that it's currently on your corporate network, it will automatically unlock the disk, so you don't have to type in your PIN. But if you boot up on a foreign network, then the machine can say, nope, that protector hasn't been satisfied, and fall back to using a PIN protector, and then prompt for the user to type in their PIN because they're not on a safe network. So that's a good enhancement. They've also added the ability for standard users to reset PINs, which is always a problem on Windows 7, that if you didn't give your users administrative rights, there was no way for them to change the PIN on the machine. So they fixed that. So overall, BitLocker then becomes much easier to deploy, much faster to deploy, much easier to deploy. The next item is UEFI. UEFI is a long story. Basically, if you go back to the original days of the IBM PC, the firmware that was used to boot the operating system initially, this was MS-DOS way back then, that firmware pretty much has been unchanged ever since. The same BIOS firmware on the machines today is, well, it's pretty much what the IBM PC was running way back in the 80s. So that's kind of gotten to the point where it's outlived its usefulness. It had a variety of limitations, especially around initialization time and performance. So there's been a concerted move in the industry to move away from that legacy BIOS and move over to a modern replacement. UEFI is that modern replacement. It's a full 32 or 64-bit boot environment that enables Windows to boot much faster, enables Windows to resume from hibernate much faster, enables Windows to sleep and resume from sleep much faster. I mean, everything that required interaction with the BIOS before now happens through UEFI and happens faster than it did before. Imagine on a legacy laptop like you have today, where the operating system starts to boot. It has to read files off of the disk. It does that by making BIOS interrupt calls, INT13 calls, to read small blocks of data from the disk. This is 16-bit code. This is code that was written by people who probably retired and moved to Florida by now. So there is nothing, no one knows how this stuff really even works anymore. No one really wants to touch this stuff anymore. They want to move over to something that allows them to take advantage of the fact that these machines have gigabytes of RAM in them. They want to be able to leverage the fact that you don't have to read data from the disk 4K at a time. You can read megabytes at a time. So moving to this faster environment is really going to be a key to get it to the point where you've probably seen the demos where these Windows 8 machines, from the time you hit the power button until the time that you can actually log on and be useful, is measured in a few seconds. In fact, if you were to look at the Windows 8 logo requirements, the logo requirements for Windows 8 state that a machine has to post, has to go through the whole power on self-test process in less than 2 seconds. If you were to test that with one of your laptops today, it might take 15, 20 seconds, and that's before the operating system can even start loading. So 2 seconds, unless the machine has a TPM in it, then it has to take 2.3 seconds or less. Still, very fast. And after that, when the operating system starts to load, it can start to load very quickly because it can take advantage of the memory in the machine, the fact that it can do large IOs. So as a result, we get to a point where we run into some new problems that we would have never envisioned a few years back. Imagine your laptop when you turn it on. What's the first thing you see? You see the OEM's logo. How long does that logo show up on the screen? A few seconds. Well, now if the whole machine post-process has to take under 2.3 seconds, guess what? The OEMs aren't happy because their logo doesn't show up long enough. That's a good problem to have. But it's a problem that they asked Microsoft to solve by continuing to show the OEM's bitmap logo even when the operating system is booting. So they'll capture the bitmap from the firmware boot screen and continue to show it while Windows is booting behind it. So you'll see the little spinning donut underneath your Dell or Lenovo or HP logo where it's spinning to show you that the operating system's already started to load. But the operating system will load very quickly. You'll get to a logon prompt very quickly and can log in very quickly. I mean, that's really key for these UEFI machines and why UEFI deployment will be so important when you're deploying Windows 8 using the new Windows 8 logo compliant machines. If you use UEFI with previous machines, the machines that are out today, you may not see a huge difference, but it still doesn't mean that it's bad to do. You may want to just start experimenting with it today, using it with your current hardware, and just get a feel for how that changes the deployment process so that when Windows 8 and the new hardware comes out, that you're able to leverage that. So I talked about UEFI being kind of new on the Windows 8 hardware, and that's true for UEFI 2.3.1. That's the latest version that adds features on top of Windows 8. But most of the hardware shipping today already supports UEFI. So if you were to take your existing HP, Dell, Lenovo machines and go into the firmware settings, the BIOS settings, there will be an option to turn on UEFI, and then you could do a UEFI deployment to that machine. I've actually done that already on my laptop. So if we were to switch over to that one, we won't see too much different. it's just like any other Windows install, where I see my operating system disk. But if I dig in deeper and look at disk management, we'll see that I have a slightly different configuration. So if I look at the properties of this disk and look at the volumes, I can see here that it says that the partition style of this disk is GPT, GUID partition table. So UEFI doesn't use MBR disks anymore. Okay, so that's one change. The impact of this is you can now have larger than 2.2 terabyte boot volumes, which, okay, we don't need that today, but we probably will in the near future. But then we also need a different disk partition structure, which we can see here. We need a recovery partition for the Windows RE, the reset, refresh my PC, things that we'll talk about later. We need a boot partition, which is the EFI system partition, which has the bootmgr.efi files and the BCD and related boot files there. And then we have the operating system partition for everything else. Now, the GUI is actually showing us three partitions here, but really there are four. And I don't completely understand why it doesn't show all four of them, but if we go into disk part, select disk zero, and then list the partitions, you can see that there really are four of them. There's this third reserved partition, which is 128 meg that is there, but it doesn't actually show up in the tools. It's just reserved for a certain disk conversion activity. So we don't need to worry about it too much, but it does need to be there. So the standard partition structure for a UEFI machine is four partitions. We set it up that way. Using GPT, using that EFI system partition, using the MSR reserve partition. That's the standard structure that we have to put in place. So if we look at something like the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit or Configuration Manager 2012 SP1, they're aware of these capabilities and they'll automatically create the right partition structure as part of the deployment. So that's one. The biggest change then is really to get this startup performance and the resume from Hibernate performance to be as fast as possible. The other benefit that we get at the same time is we'll be able to do faster Pixie booting. So UEFI actually supports multicast for Pixie booting. So it can send down a small UEFI executable, and then the rest of the boot image is actually transferred using multicast. So where we would run into challenges if we were trying to do large-scale deployments using Pixie, where we could deploy as many operating system images as we wanted using multicast, but we got into a situation where we were bottlenecked on the boot images. But if we use UEFI for that, we can eliminate that bottleneck as well. One gotcha to look at for this is if you're deploying using UEFI, UEFI is platform specific. So if you have a X64 laptop, you have to use an X64 boot image and you have to deploy an X64 OS. There's no way using UEFI to run an x86 operating system on X64 hardware. There will also be x86 UEFI computers where the hardware physically only supports an x86 operating system. In those cases, you'd boot with an x86 boot image, you'd deploy an x86 OS. There aren't any machines like that in existence today. We expect those to come out in the future, but they would be kind of the entry-level, lower-level devices, the slates, the inexpensive Intel-based machines would use UEFI x86, and you'd have to deploy an x86 OS to that. So if you haven't yet been convinced that the time is now to move to a 64-bit operating system, if you're going to deploy using UEFI so you get all of these performance benefits, you're going to have to use a 64-bit OS because all of your hardware is going to be UEFI x64 with the exception of those lower-end devices, and you'll have to deploy using a 64-bit boot image and a 64-bit OS. One of the other interesting side effects of UEFI is because that post process is so fast, Remember how you would hit the F8 key to get the advanced startup menu inside of Windows? The amount of time where you would have to hit that key would be about 1/10 of a second. And even if you're sitting there hitting that key as fast as you possibly can, you have about a 1 in 3 chance of hitting the key at the right time to get the boot menu to show up. So they had to develop a new mechanism for saying, please reboot the machine and show that advanced startup menu. So they've actually added that inside of Windows itself. Let me see if I can find it here. So if we bring up the start menu, we can bring up settings, change PC settings, general. And then we have an advanced startup option. If we click restart now, it will set it so that the boot menu will show up and then reboot the computer. So that's the mechanism now to get into that advanced startup menu that wasn't available before. Now the advantage is that we can actually display a GUI now as part of that startup process. So you won't see the standard black text-based menu that you would have seen in the past. You'll see a GUI that actually supports mouse input and touch and other things too. So that process has changed there as well. Layered on top of UEFI is a new capability called Secure Boot. And what this does is it enables the firmware to verify the boot files to make sure that they haven't been tampered with. If they've been tampered with, that would be a sign that there's been some malware that's infested the machine, so we don't want to allow the operating system to boot up because then the damage is permanent. So that is required for Windows 8 logo compliance. When you receive a machine from an OEM with UEFI with Windows 8, it will have Secure Boot enabled, but it can be turned off at any time just by going into the firmware and saying that I want to disable it. So, for example, if you bought a machine with Windows 8 and you wanted to deploy Windows 7 or some other operating system to it, the first step you would need to do is go into the firmware, turn off the Secure Boot feature, and now you can deploy whatever operating system you want to it. So, in the end, the main thing for the deployment process is to make sure that the Secure Boot environment is preserved as part of the deployment process. Like if we have a machine that has Windows 8 on it and we want to refresh it again to Windows 8, we need to make sure that that process will work. Where it gets a little messier is, let's say we bought Windows 8 logo compliant hardware, we deployed Windows 7 to it, and now we want to deploy Windows 8 to it. We can't automatically enable Secure Boot as part of that deployment process, but you could manually go into the firmware and turn it on later if you wanted to. After you've turned it on, during the next boot process, it would then verify the boot files and everything would be fine from that point forward. Applications are another big area of change. So if you look at Windows 7, you basically had one type of app. You had a desktop application. That would be installed using setup.exe, using an MSI, using whatever installation mechanism you might have had for those apps. And there were lots of different installation mechanisms. We would have liked for everyone to move over to MSI and then you just have one there, but this is new, this is better, this is changed, this is different. Instead, these applications, these modern applications, these Windows 8 applications, these M-word applications, are a new way of creating apps, a new way of packaging apps, and a new way of installing apps. So it's tied to the newest version of Visual Studio. It's very similar to the way applications are packaged up for Windows Phone, where the app basically gets bundled into what effectively is a zip file. It's a .appx file that contains all the files necessary to run that application. So the installation process for these Windows 8 apps is really just to drop that .appx file onto the system, extract the contents, and register it with the operating system. The mechanism used to do that is part of the DISM tool, the command line utility that's used for servicing Windows images. It has new options to install or provision applications. That's one of those important distinctions. If you were to go out to the Microsoft Store and find an app that you want and request it, it will get installed on the Windows 8 operating system. It'll be installed for you only. All of these applications are installed per user. So if you want that app to be used by a different person on the machine, it has to be installed again for that additional user on the machine. That's okay, but what if you want to make that app available for every user on the machine? Well, in order to do that, you have to do a separate process, a different process called provisioning. You had to provision the application onto the computer so that it then automatically installs for each user the next time they log on to the machine. In order to do that, the operating system has to be enabled for sideloading. Sideloading is basically the process of loading an app that didn't come from the Microsoft Store. Sideloading is enabled automatically for Windows 8 Enterprise when the computer is domain joined. If the computer isn't domain joined, or if you're running Windows 8 Pro or Windows RT, you would have to install a separate product key to enable sideloading. If you have software assurance, those product keys are provided to you and you can just add them. They're fairly easy to deploy. If you don't have software assurance, you can then purchase those sideloading keys so that you can sideload these applications through your own mechanism that isn't using the Microsoft Store. So installing is done per user, provisioning is done per machine. You had to think about that and how that affects the operating system deployment process that you have in place today. Let's assume that you're using MDT to do a light touch deployment. MDT runs the task sequence while it's logged on as the local administrator account. If it installed one of these applications, that app would only be available to the local administrator account, which would be useless because no one ever uses the local administrator account. They use their own account. So MDT doesn't support installing an application. It only supports provisioning an application. We can go into MDT and we can define an app saying, here's the app that we want to provision on the machine. And then that makes it available for every user on the machine. Let me switch over and show you what that looks like. So I can set up an application. In this case, I have a Bing application set up where the command line that I use for installation is just the name of the file. Can't see that. Basically, it just says bing.appx. So I don't really specify an install command line. That's just a tricky way to tell MDT that, oh, by the way, this is a Windows 8 application that I want you to install for me or to provision for me. If we were to look at the actual script, it sees that this is a appx file, and it knows as a result that it needs to enable the group policy for sideloading, and then it builds the necessary DISM command line to do the actual provisioning of the package. You could do it through PowerShell as well. There are PowerShell commandlets that do the same thing, but basically you specify for the currently running operating system, I want to add a provisioned Windows 8 application at this path, and I want to automatically accept whatever license might be tied to this. And that's pretty much about it. You just have to run that type of DISM command to say, here's the application that I want to provision on the machine. We just take care of that automatically inside of MDT by just letting you specify the details right there. So, okay, that's the MDT side of it. What about Config Manager? Again, think about a Config Manager task sequence. A Config Manager task sequence runs as a local system. What good would it do to install a Windows 8 application as local system? Wouldn't do any good at all. So we're back to that same challenge. How do we install an application via Config Manager? Well, the Config Manager guys decided that They wanted to support installation, the per-user side of it, using Config Manager 2012 SP1 and the user-focused software distribution. So you target applications to users, and they automatically install for those users. But they don't support provisioning as part of their task sequence. So I can go into Config Manager, and I can add a new application pointing at an AppX file, and it'll automatically create a deployment type that installs the AppX file, where the content is basically just the AppX file itself. So you don't have to specify any other properties. You don't have to specify command lines or anything else along those lines. It takes care of doing that for you. But I can't put one of these into a task sequence. I can only target these to the user. So this is where the user device affinity really comes in. I want to be able to specify who the primary user of this machine is as part of the task sequence, so that as soon as the task sequence completes and before that user logs in, all the apps that are targeting that user install automatically. If for some reason I wanted to provision an app as part of a Config Manager task sequence, you could do that. But in order to do that, you would have to add the run command line step that executed that same type of DISM command line that we were just looking at before that MDT uses. So just something to keep in mind, that you can always use DISM yourself to do these installation scenarios or the provisioning scenarios, whatever is appropriate. Installation would have to run as the user that you wanted to be able to run the app. Provisioning needs to run as an administrator. In either case, anytime you're installing something that isn't coming from the Microsoft Store, it's called sideloading, and we have to make sure the policy and keys are handling that appropriately. Another gotcha then is, let's say you want to build an image, and you want that image to contain a provisioned set of applications. You can do that. MDT will happily do that for you. It'll provision the apps that you specify. So you install those apps, you provision those apps as part of the process, and they all show up on the start menu inside of your deployed operating system before you sysprep and capture an image. Let's say you then wanted to rearrange how they looked on the start screen. Like if we look at my machine, I had a particular way that I wanted my start screen to be laid out. I wanted stuff that I typically look at and wanted to see on one side. I had all of my office applications in the middle, then I had development tools, and then it was pretty much everything else. But if you wanted to build a particular layout for the start screen, you had to do this manually by arranging the icons the way you want. And then as part of the sysprep process, it'll save that into a file. You can then take that file, inject it into your image, and then for each new user as they log on with that image, they'll automatically pick up that layout, and they'll see the same layout that you had so carefully arranged. So that can be done. It's just a couple of extra manual steps that you may need to go through. Hopefully there's nothing weird showing up on my screen as you're seeing Twitter messages and other things flying by. So applications are big, UEFI is big. Those are really the two biggest areas that we need to worry about. Another change that was made in Windows 8, fortunately, isn't something that we need to worry so much about. That is that Windows 8 can actually install to and boot from USB 3.0 drives. So you could build a lower cost PC that doesn't have IDE, that doesn't have SATA, that just contains USB, and install Windows to that and run Windows from that. Well, we thought that would complicate matters for our deployment tools, and we're trying to figure out how to do this, and then discovered that, well, there aren't any current plans to ship any hardware like this. Great. So we got a reprieve on that one. We don't have to worry about that yet. But eventually, we'll be able to do that, and then we'll need to make sure that the deployment tools can tell the difference between an internal USB 3 device and an external USB 3 device, because we want to deploy to internal ones, we don't want to deploy to external ones. In the future, we'll have to worry about that. For right now, though, the only thing that we have to worry about is a slight variation on that called Windows to Go. I think Andrew McMurray was doing a session this week on Windows to Go, where we basically spend 75 minutes talking about this one. But if you want to think about this, it's basically putting Windows on an external USB 3 device that can be moved from computer to computer. So you can put the full operating system onto the USB key, which has been formatted and partitioned just like we were looking at before, because it needs to support booting from UEFI computers and non-UEFI computers. So you had to format one of these into four different partitions and put the operating system and boot files in the appropriate places. Well, how many of you have ever tried to format and partition a USB key? You can format it just fine. You can't partition the thing. How do you get it so that you can partition it into four partitions so that you can do this? Well, you have to have a special device. You have to have specific hardware that's been designed for Windows to Go, because these USB keys report themselves as fixed disks to the operating system, not removable. Any fixed disk can be partitioned, any removable disk can't. So that gets around the one challenge. But they also had to have certain performance characteristics and durability characteristics. We've tried out some non-certified devices, and that gets interesting, because while you may be able to get a device that reports itself as fixed, if it doesn't match the performance characteristics, they can get really hot, to the point where you can't even touch them. And I certainly wouldn't want to be running with real data and productivity apps on a device that's getting that hot. So when the new supported, certified Windows to Go devices come out, none of those problems will exist. And Windows will actually run pretty well from these USB 3 devices. So maybe that's to enable you to do more Windows 8 testing. Maybe that's to enable the take-home scenario where you take your USB stick home with you, you plug it into your Windows 7 machine at home, and you boot it up into the Windows 8 from the USB stick. All kinds of different scenarios that you could play with this one. But the main process, the main impact from a deployment perspective is, how do you put the operating system on that stick in the first place? Config Manager 2012 SP1 includes a wizard for doing that. So you can set up a pre-staged media package. You can create a package in Config Manager containing that pre-staged media WIM, as well as the creator tool, and then advertise that out to the users so that they can do that themselves. You create the deployment so that the user can go into the software center and say, create USB stick. It asks them to insert the USB key. It deploys the Windows operating system to that, and they're set to go at that point. They plug it into a machine, it boots up, and everything's good from there. So that's one mechanism. There's also a built-in creator wizard provided in Windows 8 Enterprise so that you can do that manually yourself. Or there will be a set of PowerShell scripts that you could run. So maybe you wanted to take your MDT LightTouch image and load that onto a USB stick. So we'll provide some PowerShell scripts to show how to do that. So not too bad to do, and enable some interesting scenarios. There's also Hyper-V on the client. For those of you who carried around laptops with server OSs running on it just because you wanted to run Hyper-V, well, you don't have to do that anymore, because Hyper-V is now built into Windows 8, which is really nice, because it's just like Hyper-V running on the server. And if I were to look on my machine, that's my server, I can launch the Hyper-V tool here and see the same basic view that I would see on the server. Now, I only have one virtual machine on my laptop, and it's not currently running. But the main limitation here is we need to make sure that we have enough capacity to run virtual machines on my laptop. And yeah, I've got plenty of RAM. My laptop's got 16 gig in it, so I could probably run 5-6 VMs on it. Where it falls down is it doesn't really have enough disk space. It's running an SSD, 180 gig. My virtual machine that I use just for MDT testing is about 60 gig. There went a third of my hard drive. So yeah, you had to have the necessary hardware to support it, but if you do, then Hyper-V runs just very well on these machines. There are some specific hardware requirements, though. So you could, you may try to install Hyper-V, which is fairly easy to do. Type in Windows features. There's an option to turn Windows features on and off, and Hyper-V shows up as an option there, which I've already got installed on this machine. But there is one specific restriction on the client side that you need to make sure the machine supports, and that's called SLAT, second level address translations. So in MDT, we added an option to detect whether the machine supports SLAT, which we can actually see here. Just to make it easier as part of your task sequences, you could say, well, if this machine supports SLAT, let's install Hyper-V. If it doesn't, let's not. So that option's available. Or if you aren't using MDT, there's a core info tool from SysInternals that has the same capability. So you can run core info minus V, and it'll display if the machine supports SLAT or not. So if you have a machine that supports SLAT, you can then enable Hyper-V. Okay, how many of you are wondering, well, my machine says it doesn't support SLAT. How is it running Hyper-V? Well, there's the mysteries of hypervisors. The hypervisor is currently running on this machine, and it's hiding the capabilities of the processor from anything running on top of it, including the host OS in this case. So I can't tell that this particular machine is, that it actually supports SLAT. What I can tell, though, is that there is a hypervisor running. And because there is a hypervisor running, I know not to trust some of these other values, because I can't tell that this supports virtualization technology or hardware-assisted virtualization. I can't tell that the machine supports SLAT. But I know that it does, otherwise it wouldn't be able to run a hypervisor. So a few gotchas there, but not too bad overall. Easy to turn on, easy to make use of, and the MDT install roles and features can take care of installing that for you. As far as the mechanism used to do that, MDT is really just querying a property on the Win32 processor class in WMI that's only available on Windows 8 and also available in Windows PE 4.0, since Windows PE 4.0 is based on Windows 8. So you can easily query it from there, or if you're doing this down level, then check out the core info tool. Next on the list, refresh and reset your PC. This is basically the latest version of Windows RE, the recovery environment, which you can use to basically put the operating system back into a known state. The two options always get me confused, because every time I go through this, I have to look at it and study it for a while and think, okay, reset your PC. That's going to keep your personal data and your Windows 8 apps, but it's going to get rid of everything else. Or I'm going to do refresh your PC, which isn't going to do, well, it's going to do more. So you have to be able to figure out which one of these is which, but basically one will keep applications, Windows 8 apps and data. The other one will just wipe everything and take you back to an empty state. So if we were to look at this on my machine, go to PC settings, refresh your PC without affecting your files, a little more descriptive than it used to be, and remove everything and reinstall Windows. Both of those work by having a pre-staged Windows image that can be laid back down onto the disk. So, okay, I understand how it can preserve your files. How does it preserve apps? Well, remember when we were talking about Windows 8 apps? They're installed per user. That actually means they're part of the user profile. So to preserve Windows 8 apps and your user data really just means it's preserving your user profile as part of the remove everything, no, sorry, refresh your PC without affecting your files. So that's the way it works. It's just keeping track of the user profile settings. Everything else gets lost. So all of those desktop non-metro applications will disappear. The main thing for that one, the challenge is you need an image that can be restored. And what happens if you're going to put that image back? So let's say that you're doing an MDT deployment. You have your own custom WIM. You deployed that WIM to the machine, and then you installed apps and drivers and software updates and other things on top of that. If you took that original WIM file and said to use that as your recovery image, and now you try to reset your PC, guess what you're not going to have? You're not going to have the security updates. You're not going to have the drivers. You're not going to have all of the other things that you layered on top. So to fix that, there is a utility where you could basically boot into Windows PE and run a command line to say, take the existing running operating system and turn that into my recovery image. Basically freshen up that recovery image so that it's available for recovery in the future. It's doable, but it's very time-consuming and has some potential gotchas, especially in enterprise scenarios. So you have to think about these scenarios before you enable them for your enterprise. Great for personal use, great for home use, but for enterprise cases, it's questionable. Now, there are some scenarios where you say, well, I'd like to enable one and not the other, because I can explain to users what one of them does, but the other one, I'm not willing to chance it because they might hose themselves. But there's no way to enable one without the other. It's all or nothing. You get them both or you don't get either. There are also some changes related to storage. Initially, they announced a new file system called ReFS. First, they said, okay, it's only going to be on server for this go-around. All right. And then they said, well, you can't boot the operating system from it. Whew, that's a good item for us from a deployment perspective. We don't have to worry about needing to deploy an OS to a different file system yet. In the future, maybe there'll be another version of Windows that comes out and does support booting from ReFS. And this will probably move down to the client at some point as well. But in the short term, at least, we don't need to worry so much about this. Storage spaces, though, that is something that we might be concerned with. Now, we don't actually deploy an OS to a storage space, but we can set up data volumes as storage spaces. If you're not familiar with what storage spaces are, basically it's the ability to take a whole bunch of disks and lump them together into a pool of storage where it can handle parity volumes and replicating data and all that kind of stuff. It kind of takes the high-end SAN concepts and applies them to low-end storage devices. You just keep throwing disks at it and adding them to the pool, and it figures out what to do with them. Great, very simple, very easy, very inexpensive. So it's something that you may want to stand up on top of an already deployed OS, but fortunately at this point, it's not something that you have to worry about for the deployment process itself. So MDT, Config Manager, don't worry so much about storage spaces today. They just deploy the OS and say, well, storage spaces is something you'll configure manually after that. They've also added on the server the ability to do deduplication, which is outstanding if you have large amounts of data storage, because it will look at the block level and figure out that there are duplicate blocks because 10 different people saved the same file, or you have 150 terabytes worth of VHDs on your file server, whatever the scenario is, but it can easily take your storage space consumed and cut it in half. We've done this on some of our internal file shares and seen that the amount of space used after enabling disk duplication is a third of what it was before we turned it on. So some big benefits that you can get out just by removing duplicate blocks. So that's nice. But again, it's not something that you turn on for operating system volume, so it's not something we had to worry about during the deployment process itself. What we do need to worry about are these new types of devices that are coming out. Slates and tablets, which have some new challenges, especially lack of a keyboard. The fact that they don't have a mouse, okay, that's not a big deal because we can boot into Windows PE and still have touch support for the pre-boot environment. So we can still touch the screen and interact with it that way. But there's no on-screen keyboard in Windows PE. So there's no way to type using just the screen. We have to attach a USB keyboard to it in order to do anything of any consequence. So if you're doing zero-touch deployments, maybe using Config Manager or automated Light Touch, that's okay. You can kick off the deployment process without ever having to type anything in and then don't need a keyboard. But if you're doing anything that requires typing in a password, typing in a computer name, typing in anything else, you're going to need to attach a keyboard to these in order to do the deployments. The other challenge that you'll run into is that a lot of these devices don't have wired networking support, so they only support wireless. Well, most of the deployment processes don't work very well over wireless. So you can either switch over to using USB keys, USB storage to do the deployments, or you can have a USB Ethernet dongle that you attach to the machine so that it has a wired connection during the deployment process. It can do fine wireless only after the OS has been deployed, but the deployment processes themselves need to have a wired network connection, both for performance and just for continued availability. So Windows PE, the new version, still doesn't support wireless inside of the pre-boot environment. So let's talk then about deployment tools. So we've talked all about the different changes inside of Windows 8 and Server 2012, but now from the deployment tools perspective, first we have to talk about a new kit. I've mentioned it a few times as we've gone through, but this new kit is called the Assessment and Deployment Kit, ADK. It takes the place of Windows AIK, the Windows Automated Installation Kit. It has some existing tools, it has some new tools, but think of it as the replacement of Windows AIK. You can use it to deploy Windows 8, you can use it to deploy Windows 7, you can even use it to deploy Windows XP. Don't install it on the same machine as Windows AIK, the two of them don't get along very well, and it only supports installation on Windows 7 or above, so if you have an old Server 2003 machine that you're using for your deployment server, you may want to consider upgrading that. You'll get lots of other performance benefits at the same time by moving to at least Server 2008 R2, but ADK can only be installed on Windows 7 or above. If we look at the components that are available, let me switch back over to my server. Oops. There are several components inside of the ADK, and the bare minimum that you need to do Windows deployment using MDT or using Config Manager are the three that I've selected here. You need the deployment tools, which includes DISM and OSCD Image and BCD Boot and WIMGAPI and all those related tools. You need Windows PE, which includes the x86 and the x64 version, and you need the User State Migrations tool. All the rest of the components are useful, but for other purposes. They're not used during the deployment process itself, the nuts and bolts of laying down the new operating system. You may want to use ACT for helping with app compatibility. You might want to use VAMT for activating your computers when they don't have internet access and you're not using KMS. The Windows Performance Toolkit's really good for trying to figure out why your machine's taking so long to do certain operations. Windows Assessment Services, that's where the A comes from in ADK, is a new set of tools for assessing the performance of Windows running on lab machines. So all of the tools have a different purpose, but it's those three key tools that you would want to install on any machine that you're using with MDT or Config Manager. So as far as what's in Windows AIK versus Windows ADK, the same core tools are in both, where we've gone to a new version of Windows PE, a new version of USMT. The Windows System Image Manager tool basically hasn't changed between the two versions. DISM has picked up some new capabilities, and ImageX is still there, but long term you would want to move away from using ImageX and switch over to using DISM.exe instead. So a lot of the imaging capabilities from ImageX are now included in DISM. There's also the App Compat Toolkit 6.0, which used to be available as a separate download for the previous version. Volume Activation Management Tool, a new version of that, used to be a separate download. The Windows Performance Toolkit used to be a separate download, used to be called XPerf. If you're familiar with XPerf, this is the kit that contains XPerf and the newer versions of that, and then the Windows Assessment Toolkit. So Windows PE 4.0 includes new feature packs, including .NET 4.0 and Windows PowerShell 3.0, and a variety of PowerShell commandlets related to that. It's actually a fairly sizable list. So if we were to look on the server at the commandlets that are available, we can run PowerShell inside of Windows PE. And when we type in get command, we can see a list of all the commandlets that are available. And there are quite a few. So a lot of functionality is actually available in PowerShell inside of Windows PE. So that's nice. We already talked at length about BitLocker pre-provisioning. So that's basically a function of the new version of Windows PE, which contains a new version of the managed BDE.exe, which is needed to turn on BitLocker inside of Windows PE. The one gotcha that's worth mentioning is if you try to run Windows 7 setup.exe on Windows PE 4.0, you'll see a couple of pop-ups that say can't find entry point in DLL fastprox.dll. Click OK, shows up again, click OK, process continues. There's a compatibility issue between Windows 7 setup and the new version of Windows PE that causes that probably isn't going to be fixed. So in MDT and in Config Manager, the way we've worked around that is we just don't use setup.exe anymore. As part of the deployment processes, we've moved to just using ImageX or using DISM to apply the image directly, followed by DISM to apply the unattend and perform servicing operations, BCD boot to update the BCD entry. So we've moved away from using setup to do that logic because we can get a little better performance out of it anyway by shifting over to using those tools. The new version of USMT, the main changes with that are added support for Windows 8 and, most importantly, continued support for Windows XP. Initially, we were afraid that, okay, they're going to release USMT 5 and it's going to support migrating from Windows Vista or above to Windows 8. But there's still a fair amount of computers out there that are running Windows XP that may choose to go directly to Windows 8 bypassing Windows 7. So the fact that USMT 5 will support that operation is good news. It means that we can easily go from Windows XP to Windos 8. So USMT 5 becomes pretty much a drop-in replacement then for USMT 4. Functionality is pretty much the same. They've improved logging. They've improved error recovery. They've improved lots of things behind the scenes, including some things with the way UE and UEL work together, which has always been irritating for people. So they've made some changes like that, but for the most part, you drop in the new version and it just works fine. So in the cases with MDT and Config Manager 2012 SP1, they'll always use USMT 5. You could force it to use an earlier version of USMT 4, but for the most part, there's no real good scenario where you'd want to do that. It does mean, though, that we now have deployment tools like MDT that need to understand how to run three different versions of USMT, so there have been some changes to those tools to make sure that that works okay. Depending on the operating system that you're deploying, not the one that you're coming from. If you're deploying to XP, like an XP to XP break-fix deployment, then you need to use USMT 3. If you're deploying with the destination being Windows Vista, which probably none of you are doing anymore, then you would need to use USMT 4. But in any other scenario, USMT 4 or USMT 5 would be okay. Unless you're deploying Windows 8, then we have to use 5. Perfectly clear matrix, but fortunately we've coded that matrix inside of MDT, and it'll give you the appropriate error messages if you try to do the wrong thing. DISM we've talked about a little bit. Basically, it's going to be the place where most new deployment command line functionality gets added. So that's a tool that would be worthwhile looking at to try to figure out how it works, what it can do, what its command line options are. It tries to be kind of PowerShell-like in its command line syntax, but in the end, that really just means that the command line options are very long and require a lot of typing. So they're kind of annoying, but Fortunately, it has good help, so if you do dism/?, it will tell you what the options are that are available. The big changes in the Windows 8 version are adding support for mounting, unmounting, creating, changing WIM and VHD files. So that's the big change there. There are some new PowerShell commandlets, like for the application provisioning and installation that we talked about earlier. So you can do some things directly through PowerShell, but a lot of the functionality still requires running the dism.exe command line. If you've never looked at the Windows Performance Toolkit, I would highly recommend trying this one out because it almost becomes fun. A diagnostic tool that's easy to use and easy to drill into to see what's going on in your operating system. We've heard horror stories from customers where they've said, man, it's taking 30 minutes in the morning before I can log on and actually be productive on my computer. What's going on? Well, you can set up this tool to monitor the boot process, capturing all kinds of event tracing information into an ETR file, and then feed that file into the Windows Performance Analyzer to show you a GUI that allows you to look at the time-based performance and drill into particular slices of time and see what was going on during that time. Was it I/O bound? Was it CPU bound? Was it what was it doing? Even to the point of being able to see, okay, I can see that it's I/O bound, but what file was it accessing? What server was it talking to? What was the name of the file? What was the name of the folder? So it gives you a whole lot of detail to let you drill in and figure out what's causing these slow startup times. I can figure out that if there's something wrong with my group policy objects, if there's something wrong with my startup scripts, if there's something wrong with my antivirus software, whatever the case might be, you can use these tools to help analyze the problem. If you were to get desperate and pick up the phone and call Microsoft support and say, help us send someone out here to troubleshoot our slow startup, they're going to send you a premier field engineer who runs these tools and makes it look easy. But really, it is easy. It's easy to use this tool to try it out. Don't try to do it in a crisis situation. That's why I'd say go back and play with it and try it out and see what you can do with this tool to tell you about your startup process. Maybe you have a bad driver. Maybe you have whatever the situation might be, this can help you identify what those issues are. Question? Does it work on Windows 7? Yes, it works on Windows 7. The executables that get installed as part of the ADK, you would have to copy them to the Windows 7 system that you're running them if you didn't want to install the whole ADK on the machine. So it's fairly easy, and the documentation explains how to do that. Then there's also a large set of assessment tools, and these become a little bit more interesting because they're mainly for large lab environments where we want to be able to run a whole suite of tests against a whole bunch of computers where we've deployed, say, a custom or standard image to them and measured the results. So it's all about automated testing. So if you're the type of enterprise that has a dedicated lab with one of everything, one of every type of PC that you support sitting in it, this might be a tool that you could make use of to try to automate the testing of your image against all of these different types of machines. If you're not that type of customer, this is going to be very interesting to you. It's really designed for those larger scale scenarios where you can justify having that type of dedicated lab space. Not surprising that this is very much used by OEMs. So OEMs, as they're preparing for the Windows 8 certification process, they would use this to make sure that they're meeting all the OEM logo requirements as defined by Microsoft. So it's very much focused on that problem space, being able to make sure that the machine boots up fast enough, starts up fast enough, drivers load fast enough, video performance is fast enough, IE performance is fast enough, measures all that kind of stuff. But it does require kind of a dedicated lab environment to run in. Disk part is going to go away at some point. Fortunately, not yet. If you installed the Windows 8 consumer preview and typed in diskpart.exe, it would come back with a message that says, this command line tool is being deprecated and might not be available in the future. Well, the problem is everyone panicked when they read that and assumed that future might mean Windows 8 RTM. No, what they were saying is, sometime, potentially years in the future, this tool may go away. So start getting used to using PowerShell to do the same thing. So they introduced a new set of PowerShell commandlets that can be used to do all of the same things that diskpart can do, and much easier than using diskpart. If you've ever written a script that dynamically generates a diskpart script and then feeds that into diskpart and then tries to figure out if it worked or not, it's nasty. Using that in PowerShell is very easy. But for the time being, diskpart continues to work, so tools like MDT and Config Manager will continue to use diskpart for the time being, but in the future we'll make the switch over to PowerShell. Roles and features. The big change here is that there are variations in the role and feature installation process for each version of the OS that we had to deploy. So the tools like MDT that had to figure out how to do this have basically restructured all of the processes so that they know for this OS do this, for this OS do something different, for this OS do a third thing, for this OS do a fourth thing. There are basically, I think, 6 different ways of installing roles and features now, depending on whether you're running Windows XP all the way up through Server 2012. Some are PowerShell based, some are command line based, some are there are just lots of differences. So if you're using MDT, it'll handle all of this for you. If you're not using MDT and you wanted to install roles and features on Windows 8, you'll want to use DISM, or the PowerShell equivalent to the DISM command, the enable feature command. If you're doing this on Server 2012, you'll want to use the Server Manager PowerShell module to do this, because it provides all of the necessary understanding of dependencies between features and all of the logic to make it easy, so that you could do something like saying, I want to install IIS, and it will figure out that that means that there are 37 different components that need to be installed behind the scenes. So the main thing to keep in mind is Server Manager CMD, which is the command line utility that was supported for Server 2008 R2, was deprecated in Server 2008 R2. It doesn't exist in Server 2012. That one went away. So you have to switch if you're still using Server Manager CMD.exe. OC Setup, which was the server core equivalent, also has gone away in the Windows Server 2012 core install. So in that case, too, you need to switch over to using the Server Manager PowerShell module. A couple other items. When you're deploying Windows 8, the start screen can get in the way. Fortunately, we provided a mechanism in MDT where you could say hide the shell, and as a result, the whole deployment process runs before the start screen can ever display itself. We do that by running the process from run once registry keys so that the start screen doesn't finish until all the run once keys are done. There's also a nice feature inside of Explorer. After how many years, it now knows how to mount an ISO and a VHD file. So you can just find those in Explorer, right-click, and say mount, and it'll take care of the rest. So that gets us to deployment products. MDT 2012 Update 1 is the release to support deployment of Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012. It was just released. The Windows 8 functionality includes support for ADK, provisioning of Windows 8 applications, BitLocker pre-provisioning, role and feature installation, and UEFI support. In the case of Configuration Manager, the support for Windows 8 and Server 2012 deployment is in Config Manager 2012 SP1. The beta was released yesterday. It was released this week, so you can download that and install it in your labs and start experimenting with it. Their support is for the ADK, for the installation of Windows 8 applications, BitLocker pre-provisioning, and also UEFI support there. The full release for that one is expected within about 90 days of Windows 8 general availability. For those of you who are keeping track, Windows 8 general availability is in late October. So within 90 days of late October, the SP1 release should be out there to fully support Windows 8 deployment. So that's pretty much it. I would just encourage you to download Windows 8 today. It's available on the Volume Licensing Service Center. It's also available for TechNet Plus and MSDN subscriptions. The ADK is available on the Download Center. MDT 2012 Update 1 is on the Download Center. You can download the SP1 beta. It's also on the Download Center. Try them all out and see how the Windows 8 deployment process works. For the most part, it doesn't change drastically from the Windows 7 deployment process. There are new versions of tools that we've had to integrate into the processes, but overall, the end-to-end process doesn't look that much different than it did before. If you have any questions related to it, we have the MDT OSD mailing list hosted through myitforum.com, TechNet forums out on the TechNet website, and we have a Facebook page out on Facebook as well. So that is pretty much it. And that finishes up my session. I will actually be at the Windows booth tomorrow morning and Friday morning, so if you have any other questions related to Windows 8 or Windows 8 deployment, track me down there. Otherwise, please fill out your evaluations, and thanks for attending.